The Tom Woods Show, episode 1392.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm picking up where we left off, more or less, a couple of episodes ago, 1390. Kevin Gutzman and I looked at just a handful of a very lengthy series of anti-libertarian tweets by a Terry Canfield, and we talked about who she is. That doesn't really matter because the point is not her. The point is the ideas she's putting forward. She had a series of tweets some time ago. I think it was about 29 of them. And she was trying to show, you know, the undesirability of libertarianism for one reason or another. And most of the arguments she made are pretty standard. These are arguments that we've answered quite a few times. But she has not read any real libertarian. She's read David Bowes. She didn't like him, but that seems to be about it. She thought that his presentation of American history shared a little bit too much in common with white supremacists. I don't understand how somebody could be that much of an emotional hypochondriac to read a book like that and draw that kind of conclusion, but unfortunately we're surrounded by such people. So anyway, the point is not to go after her as a person, plus there's no point in doing that, but rather that when critics like this raise issues like this, it's an opportune moment for us to go back and review what do we think about some of these issues. And some of them are, let's say, easier to reply to than others. Some of them are more common arguments than others. And I try to make this podcast into a vehicle through which you can learn more about libertarianism. You can defend it better, and you can understand better how a free society would work. It's easy. It takes no mental exertion whatsoever to understand how a coercive solution would work. A guy orders somebody else to do something, the person does it. It takes more mental energy to figure out what the unintended or undesirable consequences of the coercive solution are, and it takes still more mental energy to imagine what a non-coercive solution would have looked like in the first place. And so that's what I want to try and do in this and, well, virtually all my episodes. So I'll link to the thread at tomwoods.com/1392. But I thought I would look at just a couple of these for today because there's plenty of material to cover in just these couple. But before I do that, I mean, in my Twitter feed recently, I had somebody say that libertarian philosophy is, quote, white supremacist. What's the argument for this? And there isn't really one. And so I responded and I said, all right, so libertarian philosophy now is white supremacist. Got that? If you oppose the initiation of force against anyone, you are a white supremacist. Only if you favor violence will this person let you off the hook. Try to make sense of that. So I go back and look now, and she's locked her account. So only her confirmed followers can even see her tweets anymore. In some way, that's encouraging to me that you try and say something preposterous like that, smearing millions of people, showing a complete lack of comprehension of anything, and there is a massive response. Well, that does encourage me. Then another guy, libertarianism is an idea designed to work only for white people, and not even working class white people at that. Oh. Where do you even begin? Let's see. Africa has had something like the opposite of libertarianism, certainly throughout the 20th century and in most countries after decolonization. They had statism because a lot of the African leaders had been, heaven help them, educated in the West, and they took terrible Western ideas back to Africa with them, and the result was pretty predictable. As for working class people of any race, they all have vastly higher standards of living today. There is less poverty now than there's ever been, ever in the history of the world. I heard somebody on Dave Smith's show, apparently he's a philosophy professor, Yeah, talk about heaven help us. Saying to Dave, well, the reason that people are doing better today is that we have all these social programs. Ah, no, 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 you just walked right into the trap, you poor sap. You walked right into the trap because the countries where we saw the greatest fall in poverty because of liberalization of economies and of markets are countries that were so poor they couldn't afford a welfare state. Are countries where there was really no welfare state worth speaking of because they're too poor to fund it. That's what makes them a poor country. And yet they emerged from that poverty. And since they emerged from it before there was a welfare state, you can't credit the welfare state with that success. Anyway, all right, I had to get those couple off my chest. Let's get back to Terry Canfield. And I'm just going to pick two today, two more things to talk about, chosen more or less at random. First is, the funny thing is she's a crony capitalist, as it turns out. She says this, libertarians seem to apply the term creative destruction to letting entire industries or banks fail. Let them fail. A new, better thing will arise from the ashes. Here's the problem, she says. If a bank or major industry fails, it will inflict pain and suffering on large numbers of people. All right, so let's pause right there. So that is to say, she wants some kind of, subsidy or special privilege for a failing bank or industry? So that is to say, people who are producing things that other people want should have their resources taken away and transferred to people who are producing things people don't want. And that's more just? And so, therefore, the resources of society, instead of being directed toward ends that satisfy the preferences of the mass of the public, are to be directed toward the ends of politically favored groups? That's what she considers justice to be? I can't help mentioning the horse and buggy industry. That is the classic example. What were we to do there? Should we keep the horse and buggy industry going? Should we seize resources from other industries and pour them into helping people in the horse and buggy industry? So in other words, should we impoverish everybody for the benefit of a few? Again, is that her principle of justice? And so a bank can't fail, apparently. So here's the person who's going to be critical of capitalism and critical of libertarianism, but she's not going to let a bank fail. She's going to let the bank be bailed out, basically. Because supposedly she's protecting the little guy. Yeah, when you bail out a bank, I'm sure you're really protecting the little guy. I mean, the naivete is unbelievable with a lot of anti-libertarians. They're the ones who want to prop up the fat cats, and we're the ones who want market discipline to hit them, you know, in the rear end. She says, if major industries fail, the people who suffer could number in the millions. In the millions. Well, first of all, it's very, very unusual for an entire industry to fail. A firm might fail, a bunch of firms might fail, but for an entire industry to fail that is not be desired at all anymore, that means something major has happened. There's been a major shift in people's tastes or in available technology. I mean, there are all kinds of explanations as to why an entire industry might fail, but an entire industry. That is severe. That is some kind of serious judgment by market participants. They don't want this thing anymore. And apparently Terry Canfield thinks, well, doggone it, they're going to get it anyway. You're just going to keep on getting it. It doesn't matter what you choose. This is somebody who prides herself on democracy, by the way. She loves democracy. All right, well, here's democracy. People voting with their dollar bills saying, we don't want this thing anymore. And her saying, well, I don't care. I've decided you're going to have it. I've decided these people are going to keep producing this thing you don't want. And we're going to arbitrarily decide how long they're going to keep producing the thing you don't want. And we're going to arbitrarily decide how many resources that would normally be directed elsewhere at things you want. Well, I've decided to override your preferences and devote an arbitrary number of resources to this failing industry. So that's her principle of justice, that her preferences override everybody else's because she thinks that people producing things that nobody wants anymore deserve some kind of special attention. The entire economy proceeds precisely because sometimes there are failures. The failures mean that resources have been poorly deployed, and they need to be redeployed more in line with consumer preferences. That's how we make sure that resources don't get wasted. That's how we make sure that we, to the extent possible, have the most optimal deployment of resources. Anything other than that just makes people poor to one degree or another. Seriously, what would the economy look like if she had her way? We'd have fax machines all over the place that nobody's using, that nobody's buying. So what would this look like? You'd keep producing things nobody wants, and then how would you force them into retail outlets? If retail outlets know nobody's buying them, they're not going to order them. So therefore, no wholesaler is going to want them. Well, what are you going to do? It's really easy to send out some tweets about how much suffering there is in the world because people have to adapt to changes, but that's just a fact of reality. As for banks, she says, imagine what would happen if a major bank fails. I'm sure she's studied this in great detail. She says, large numbers of people would lose everything and fall into poverty. Well, well, well. I actually talked to somebody who's an expert on this very subject right here on this podcast. And that's Charles Calamiris, who's a professor at Columbia Business School. And we talked about banks, banking, FDIC, deposit insurance. This was all the way back in episode 213. That is quite a long time ago. And I want to share with you a couple of passages from the transcript of that particular episode. I have transcripts of all the interviews I do for the supporting listeners. So that's another reason to join me over at supportinglisteners.com. And here's what we talked about that's relevant to that claim. Let's start here. Calamiris says, I also want to say another academic consensus, again, not very well covered in the literature, the popular literature of the press, is that protection of banks is the reason globally for the pandemic of banking crises that we've had, thinking not just within the U.S., but all over the world. So here's the very thing this woman thinks is going to save us. And Calamiris, who's actually an expert on this, and tells us that that's actually the consensus of the academic literature, which, of course, you can be absolutely certain Terry Canfield couldn't even name you one author of. But she's going to spout off about, well, it seems to me, after thinking about it for 12 seconds, that probably, if 12 seconds is probably dignifying it too much, that probably everybody would just lose all their money in this situation. So we therefore need to protect the banks. Well, it turns out that protection of the banks is the primary driving force behind all the banking instability we've had. So again, continuing with Calamiris, he says, if you look at, I would say, about 100 articles that have been written and published in academic journals, and all the researchers are working at, let's say, the IMF and the World Bank, as well as the Federal Reserve and the Academy, we're all in agreement that the protection of banks has been the most important influence driving this pandemic of banking crises. And the U.S. is no different. Banks, especially during the merger wave that occurred in the U.S. in the 1980s and the 1990s, that merger wave happened in a particular way. It coincided with an increasing protection of banks, the expansion of the safety net, deposit insurance, the bailout of Continental Bank in 1984. Now, what does he mean by this pandemic of banking crises? Right? I mean, you would think, well, I thought only that only happened in the 19th century. Okay, well, here's what Calamiris says. He says, there were in U.S. history, we had these banking panics in 1857, 1873, 1884, several of them. But from 1873 through 1907, although we had six panics, the worst of those in terms of bank losses as a fraction of GDP was 1893, where it was only 0.1% of GDP. Now, by any modern standard, that is a very small number. To give you an idea, the Great Depression in the U.S. was about 2.5% of GDP of the negative net worth of failed banks relative to GDP. So when we see something that's about 1% of GDP or bigger, I think we can call that a major banking crisis in terms of failure. Less than 1% is kind of debatable. So I like to use as a simple metric of the second kind of definition of a crisis, about 1% of GDP. To give you an idea about the past, from 1874 worldwide to 1913, about a 40-year period, there were only six such events in the world. Banking crises defined in terms of the negative net worth of banks, failed banks, relative to GDP in excess of 1%. And in the U.S., we had six liquidity crises, none of which, as I said, got anywhere near 1% of GDP. So there were about 12 crises that were severe liquidity crises, all in the U.S., or severe failure crises over that period. So as you can see, we have ways of defining these things, and that by that kind of definition of either a liquidity crisis or a major solvency crisis, there are only about a dozen over that 40-year period. If we apply that same definition, as two IMF researchers did, we'll find more than 100 such crises over a similar 40-year period that we're just ending. And the severity is also much greater. The losses of failed banks relative to GDP in that historical period, where I talked about those dozen, averaged about 2 or 3% of GDP for those dozen crises. For the ones we've had worldwide in the last 40 years, it's about 16% of GDP. So we've had, let's say, about 10 times as many crises, and they are about 5 times as severe. All right, well, I don't think Terry Canfield knows that. And then when I said to Calamiris, look, I hear what you're saying, and this is all really shocking information, frankly, but that on the other hand, the average Joe wants to know that if he puts his money in the bank, it's going to be safe, and he doesn't want to lose his money. How do you answer that? And he said, well, unfortunately, the jury is in on this question. In the theoretical literature, you can argue in favor of deposit insurance and other government protections, saying, well, you know, maybe it makes everyone safer because the government is protecting them. The problem is you've got this offsetting effect that protection makes you take more risk. And so you're a depositor. Yes, you get protected, but you're also a taxpayer. You have to pay for that protection. As I said, the average of the over 100 banking crises that we've had has cost those countries' taxpayers about 16% of GDP to bail out those banking systems. So yeah, you're getting protection in your right-hand pocket as a depositor, but you're paying for that protection out of your left-hand pocket as a taxpayer. And there is no question that you are on balance much worse off by creating that protection. So if you remember the statistics I quoted at the beginning of our discussion, going back to the 40-year period from 1874 to 1913, which was the period where there's lots of banking all over the world, very, very free capital flows. We were under a very rigid monetary system called the gold standard. You might think, oh, gee, all that unprotected banking must have been a disaster. But in fact, it wasn't. What's interesting is it was a disciplining system. Here's the way I like to put it to my students. If bankers aren't scared, we're not safe. In the old system, bankers were scared. Whom were they scared of? Their depositors. They were scared that if any semblance of misconduct by them got out, they would experience a run. They very rarely experienced runs because they were scared. And when they were scared, they were careful. We've lost that. Deposit insurance and other government protections have taken that away from us. Unfortunately, you put your finger right on the problem. It sounds very good and is very politically popular to protect bank depositors. And of course, bankers use that to get the political protection that they depend on to hatch their risky strategies. And of course, they are the ones laughing all the way to the bank with their very high salaries and their big stock options and all the rest of it. Well, how about that? Wasn't that worth sharing? Episode 213, I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1392. How about that? You would not get even an inkling of any of that information based on the cartoonish version of reality that we get from this Terry Canfield. All right, that's the first one of the two topics I wanted to hit from Canfield today. That one, I think, is pretty decisive. Second one, coming up in just a second, but I want to say a word to all you folks who, like me, feel totally overwhelmed. There's so much information you want to absorb. You have only so much time in which to absorb it. And a really great tool to overcome this problem is an outstanding app called Blinkist, because Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the really need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and then just condenses them down into 15 minutes that you can either read or listen to. So you can very realistically, in a standard commute, have listened to the guts of 4 books. Imagine being exposed to the ideas in 4 books every single day. That's precisely why I like Blinkist. Of course, I use it when I'm driving my daughters all over the place. I've managed to read old classics like How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, and more modern books like Getting Things Done by David Allen. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/woods. All right, let's get back to Terry Canfield. The reason I hate the stupid word triggered, but I get irritated by people like this, is just the low level of the argument. She's uttering commonplaces that we've all heard in our classrooms since, third grade. And she presents them as these profound insights that we may never have encountered before. What are you talking about? Everyone's heard this. It shocks me if there are people who have a dissenting voice from that. I mean, I'm not at all shocked that she believes this stuff. I mean, every uncreative person in the world believes every single thing that's taught to them in these textbooks. I mean, of course, you just memorize it and regurgitate it on the test, and then you pat yourself on the back for how smart you are. All right. Okay. But it doesn't impress me. You're a person with a fertile mind, a creative mind, a curious mind, should be checking out some of this stuff, looking at other sources. I mean, for heaven's sake, with the internet around you. So she'll say things like this. The Constitution grants the federal government power to create laws that provide for, quote, the common welfare, unquote. Now, she's a lawyer, and she doesn't know that the phrase is the general welfare. We'll let that go. And so she says, we have federal agencies and lots of laws because they promote the common welfare. So there's no public choice theory in her view. And of course, she thinks that she believes that crazy book about James Buchanan, one of the real brains behind public choice, Nancy McLean's book. She believes the whole thesis about that. So of course, she's not even going to consider public choice. But again, how naive can you be? Yeah, we have all these things because they help us. They don't feather the nests of bureaucrats. They don't exist for the sake of perpetuating themselves. There's none of that. We'd all be dead in a ditch without them, is her analysis. So one of these days in the, somewhat near future, or maybe I'll take more than one day, I'm going to go through the different federal agencies. Let's look at what exactly they do. What do these things do? I mean, a lot of people, if you were to ask them, what does the Department of Commerce do, would have no idea. What does the Department of Energy do? I don't know. I actually don't know. I'm against it, but I actually don't even know what it does. So I think I'm going to do that sometime down the road. And we'll see how well it lines up with this claim that they're there because they help us. Well, anyway, the other topic I'll get into really quickly is, can I trade stocks on inside information? She asks that question. Now, of course, she's asking it in a way that implies that the obvious answer is it's ridiculous that we're even raising this because don't you know all respectable people know that you shouldn't be allowed to do that. But okay, if that's the level somebody's at, I can't help that person. But if you're willing to say, well, I don't know, why don't I look into that? Instead of just in a knee-jerk fashion, assuming that whatever regulation currently exists is optimal, must be the best, and in fact, probably the only way for us to live. And here I want to share with you some insights, in particular from Bob Murphy, because he's really, really done good work on this. He's got a great article. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1392 that goes into this. And the thing is, I like the illustrations he uses, and so that's why I want to make use of them myself. So he reminds us, first of all, that stock prices are not just arbitrary. They do mean something. And so he says, let's consider this thought experiment. Let's suppose Microsoft's share price tumbled from, it's a little over $120 a share now. But if it tumbled, let's say, all the way down to $1, well, what would be the result of that? Well, it's quite likely you'd get a corporate raider who would borrow money, buy a controlling share in the company, and then sell off all the company assets to the highest bidders. But with the share price at over $120, it's much, much more difficult to break up a successful company like Microsoft. And so the price is the market's way of saying that the assets currently owned by the Microsoft Corporation are best deployed by Microsoft, and it would not be it would be suboptimal. It would be an outright bad thing to grab those assets and just somehow try and integrate them into all different firms all over the world, just disperse them in the manner of a corporate raider. You can't do that with the price being $123 or whatever it is per share. So in other words, it prevents successful, socially useful companies from just being arbitrarily broken up. Now, some companies should be broken up, but not all of them. And that's one of the functions the share price serves. Well, anyway, speculators serve a useful social function. And that's true of all kinds of speculators. Walter Block defends speculators in Defending the Undefendable. And people, of course, are taught to hate speculators, but speculators are not bad. They help make prices adjust as quickly as possible. And the more prices reflect reality, the less dislocation there is when circumstances change, like a supply shock or whatever else. You want prices to adjust quickly so that the whole economy can adjust to the new circumstances. So if somebody uses so-called inside information and makes a stock purchase on that basis, what that person is doing is helping to accelerate the movement of that stock price to where it's eventually going to wind up and make that happen quickly. So Bob gives the example of the Acme Corporation. Let's say you got a Wall Street trader, he's sitting at a bar and he hears an executive on his cell phone talking about good news for the Acme Corporation. So the trader decides, well, now I know some stuff that other people don't know. I'm going to go buy 1,000 shares of the Acme Corporation for $10 a share. And then this great news turns out to be real. It becomes public and the stock jumps from $10 a share to $15 a share. And then the trader, now he bought 1,000 shares at $10 a share. So he spent $10,000. But now that his 1,000 shares are worth $15 per share, he now has $15,000 worth of shares. And he could just close out that position and he walks away with a profit of $5,000. So the question is, who is the victim here? Who's actually harmed in this? He didn't harm the people who sold him the shares. Those people were already trying to sell anyway, and they would have just sold to somebody else if they hadn't sold to him. In fact, by being willing to buy 1,000 shares, he may well have helped to keep the share price at $10. If it hadn't been for him, maybe people would have had to sell for $9.75. So at the very least, people who sold him the shares were not hurt in any way, and if anything, may have been slightly helped by him. What if you had held stock in the Acme Corporation before this trader's activities, and you held that stock all throughout his activities? Are you harmed? Obviously not. Your share price goes up just like that of any holder of that stock, and that's it. You haven't been harmed. How have you been harmed? So who are the only possible people who might have been harmed? And it's a very, very tiny sliver, and the harm is, well, maybe infinitesimal. We're just talking about people who were themselves trying to buy shares of Acme Corporation at that same moment. So this trader goes in, buys those 1,000 shares. All right, so there are fewer shares available for other people to acquire. Or his demand for the 1,000 shares forces other people buying shares at that time to pay maybe a very slightly higher price for them, so that when they do go to $15 a share, their profit won't be as great as it would have been if that guy hadn't been in the market demanding 1,000 shares. Okay, but even that is not even, is barely worth mentioning. So as Bob says, all that's really happened here is that somebody has knowledge that then helps to adjust the price, but he has knowledge that he profits from. And if he hadn't profited from it, then all the profit would have just gone to, you know, some existing investors as a matter of dumb luck. Why is that morally superior? And then Bob reminds us that it's good to have a lot of speculators around. You want markets for securities to be liquid. And let's say you've got a bunch of rich speculators ready to pounce on what they perceive as a mistake in pricing. Well, then this is actually good for, let's say, as Bob says, let's say you have an institutional investor, like a firm managing pensions, and they suddenly have a cash crunch and they have to dump their holdings. Speculators will swoop in and put a floor under the fire sale price. And that's good for the beleaguered pension fund. That's good for the stock market. We want this. And then finally, Bob points out that Murray Rothbard, in his book, Making Economic Sense, I remember the first edition of that book, I actually compiled the index for that. Oh my gosh, is that not a job I would want to repeat? But I did the index for Making Economic Sense. I have fond memories of this book. The book I liked, the indexing, that was another matter. But anyway, Bob recalls a piece from that book in which Rothbard says that, look, in a technical sense, every firm on Wall Street is technically engaged in insider trading, because if they literally rely only on information available to the public, how would they ever make any money? And this is why the state loves insider trading, because you can accuse practically anybody of it. And so it is a sword of Damocles you can hold over any person or firm you want to. And Bob concludes by saying, the practice of insider trading, and then by implication in a free society, would not be a criminal offense, because it is impossible to define the concept in a way that wouldn't bar legitimate speculative research and trading. In practice, these laws give the government a very blunt club with which to knock down any profitable firm it wishes. Now, let me ask you, do you think Terry Canfield has ever considered any of this? Has ever even given it a thought? Or is it rather that, well, this is a very unpopular opinion that sounds bad to me, so I think I'll just denounce it? I believe that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a supremely uncreative and uncurious mind that is glad to look simply at the surface of things, to accept the conventional wisdom on pretty much everything. That's what we're dealing with. And yeah, libertarianism is not going to be a good match for this person. Libertarianism is the exact opposite of what this person is prepared to hear. All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. I'll link to the thread, as I said, at tomwoods.com/1392 if you want to look at it. I'll come back to this. We'll hit some of the other topics that she talks about. I can only imagine her views of cryptocurrency. That's not mainstream, so that must also be wrong by definition. But I bring up cryptocurrency because I've gotten some nice feedback on some videos that I've put together for you if you are interested in accepting Bitcoin in payment, whether you have an online business or you're just selling something here or there, or you just like to accept Bitcoin payment for one reason or another, but you just think, I'm never going to figure this out, forget it. Well, you are leaving money on the table, because there are some people who will be glad to patronize you if you accept Bitcoin in particular. So I've got some resources for you. A video series walks you through step by step, very simple, exactly how to do it. So get that over at tomwoods.com/Bitcoin, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.